We're going to call to order the meeting of the Senate Committee on Rural Communities and Economic Development on April 23rd, 2013. And we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3125. If you saw the original agenda, it had 2441. At the first, we're holding it off till, because we have a representative that wants to come and testify, and he happens to be on the floor right now. So we're giving him a little chance to get here. So with that, we're going to open our public hearing on House Bill 3125, and we'll have a short explanation of the bill by our committee.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, House Bill 3125A has no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact. It eliminates the provision prohibiting the division of forest land to facilitate forest practice, resulting in parcels smaller than the minimum lot or parcel size when a dwelling is involved. It also makes other changes to clarify statute provisions.
Thank you very much. Do we have a... So with that, we'll ask Heath to come on up. Come on, Heath. We appreciate the time you spend with our committee.
Oh, thank you.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, my name is Heath Curtis, and I'm with the Oregon Forest Industries Council. We're here in support of House Bill 3125. 3125 is necessary because of a minor mistake in a statute in 1996. The land use statutes, as you're probably aware, are pretty complex, and this one's no exception, but I think I can explain it to you relatively efficiently. The general structure of a lot of our land use statutes is they say, here's the minimum parcel size for a lot of land given a designated use, and then here are exceptions to that minimum parcel size. So in Chapter 215, Section 780, we provide that the minimum parcel size for forest land, for lands zoned for forest use, is 80 acres. Then we have some exceptions in that. And there were two that were added in 1996. One of them said that you can divide land into smaller than 80-acre parcels to facilitate a forest practice, right? And you could divide it into a parcel smaller than 35 acres under only one of two exceptions. That is, it could be smaller than 35 acres if to facilitate a land exchange with a government agency, or it could be parcelized into a parcel smaller than 35 acres if you were selling land, if one party to the transaction was a large forest landowner who already owned more than 2,000 acres of forest land. You're asking kind of, why would we carve these out? Well, the policy rationale behind that second one was what we style the mom-and-pop exception. If mom-and-pop own a piece of forest land and they're late in life and they want to sell that property to kind of realize on their lifetime investment, they frequently want to keep their house. And if they sell the property to a big timber company, the timber company doesn't want to be a landlord, right? They don't want to have to be managing people on their property. And so the idea here was that they would be able to divest their assets, they could sell their property, and keep a small parcel with their house on it, under the condition that no new house could be created on either the parcel sold or the parcel kept. That is, it's just an imaginary line that changes, and the timber company gets to purchase property that's valuable to them, and at the same time, mom and pop get to realize on their investment. Unfortunately, in 1996, when the statute went down, we actually have pretty good notes on this. The LC, in the final days of drafting the amendment, included a final provision that said, unless either parcel has a house on it, has a dwelling on it. That is to say, it can be smaller than 80 acres if it's to facilitate a forest practice, and it can be smaller than 35 acres if it involves a big timber company, and then they put unless either parcel has a house on it. Well, that defeats the entire purpose of the mom-and-pop exception. Usually the only reason somebody wants to keep a little parcel like that when they're selling off land is because it has a house on it. That's precisely the reason. So we had a member approach us, said, this is a problem. The statute isn't working the way it was supposed to. We have good notes on why it should have been drafted differently. All this bill does, notwithstanding all of the revised text you see in here, the only substantive change is striking that provision that says unless there's a dwelling involved on either parcel. That is, now the mom-and-pop exception works as I described it to you initially if you were to support this bill. As I understand, it passed out of the House Land Use Committee unanimously and off the House floor. We don't are not aware of anybody who has problems with the statute, but I'm totally open to questions. The land use laws are convoluted, and this one is no exception. But that's the genesis of the issue and our proposed resolution.
So questions for, yes, Senator Pozanski.
Heath, you say 96. I'm trying to think. The bill looks like it was passed in 95. And then it sounded like you were thinking that there was some other session that the exceptions were put into it. And if that's the case, it wasn't 96, because that would have been an even number year. And in those days, the effective date of the legislation passed in 95 would have been 90 days after session, which would have been the end of 95. So I'm just wanting to see if we got those notes as to when those actually took place, if that was part of the 95 bill.
It was. Senator, Chair Roblin, Senator Pozanski, it is. It's the 95 law, and I triggered off of because it's at the very end, and they would have started using it in 1996. But yes, correct. I mean, the notes we have are our correspondence with LC when these exceptions were created. Our member, Seneca, was actually in the process of doing a land exchange with a state agency at the time, and we had included also this mom-and-pop exception because this happens a lot. And frankly, without this, frankly, what usually happens when the mom-and-pop sell off their land is their house gets bulldozed, right? They sell it off and they lose their home, and because it's the only way for them to realize on their investment. Here, however, to the extent that the buyer is willing to kind of go through the process and the county actually adopts these minimum lot sizes, this gives them an alternative where mom and pop get to keep the home.
Yeah, I mean, there's other ways that could be done, but I understand that this is the way it was done. I'm somewhat surprised 95
to now it hasn't been an issue.
Right. I mean, is this coming up now? I mean, knowing I've sat on all the committees that have dealt with land use, and this is the first time I've heard this one.
Yep.
Life estates. I mean, there's a lot of ways that you could have taken care of mom and pop, but I understand.
Okay.
Yes, Heath, could you elaborate a little bit on the to divide an area of land zone mixed farm and forest part of this?
Sure. So if you're looking, I believe if you're Chair Roblin, Senator Bearchager would be happy to. I believe you're looking at sub C.
Yeah, line 17, page 2.
Exactly. So my first comment on that, subs B and C, you can see a lot of rewriting there, but that really is a function of two things. One, legislative council just kind of making the language more efficient. And two, Chair Clem on the House side requested that the requirement that the dwelling have existed since before June 1st, 1995, that actually be moved up into the operative language under sub C instead of being one of the listed conditions for the parcelization. But to your question, sub C for mixed farm and forest use says that they can create a smaller smaller parcel. They can establish a parcel for purposes of a dwelling that existed since before June 1st, 1995. And that provision has, you know, as you can see, the restrictions that exist there. For farm and forest, they also include sub big C and D, that is, the minimum tract eligible under the paragraph is 40 acres. So for mixed farm and forest, you can subdivide for a house that was pre-95, but the minimum is only 40 acres. It has to be at least 40 acres, and the tract should be predominantly in forest use, qualified for forest special assessment. But to your question, I think we're not proposing to change anything substantively about that subprovision, that section. It's only sub little d, and it's only to delete sub big e.
Senator Pozanski.
Heath, can you give us a clarification? I'm trying to look up the statute that you cite on the bullet, and it's missing a numerical number after the 780. should be a 1, 2, 3, or something, because we don't go just to the sub D, small d.
So it would be, with apologies, it's sub 2, sub small d. So you can see in sub 2, you know, sub 1 provides, here's what the minimum lot sizes are. And sub 2 then provides that a county may adopt smaller lot or parcel sizes under the following circumstances. And so then you have A, which is the generic, if they can evidence that they can continue to meet the requirements of the land use laws and the land use goals. And then B is for pre-95 houses in forest use lands. C is for pre-95 houses in mixed farm and forest use lands. And then D is the section we've been discussing today. So that would be, again, to facilitate a forest practice, in which case it can't be smaller than 35 acres, unless it's either A, for purposes of a land exchange with a state agency, or B, one of the parties is, you know, larger than, owns more than 2,000 acres of forest land. But again, I think that the point here is that this was kind of a compromise that was reached with the 95 legislation, and that this final provision, it's been looked at by a lot of people, and we've not had anybody pushing back against it.
And in actuality, as I looked over it, and I know staff looked, we kept trying to figure out, because there's a lot of changes here,
correct,
it looks like. But the only substance one we could find was exactly the same one that you just mentioned about the 35 in the house.
Precisely.
All the rest of it was, it appeared that the drafter was trying to make the language clearer for all of the other stuff. But
Chair Roman,
we could find nothing that actually changed any substance. Is that, yeah.
Chair Roman, please believe we would have preferred, frankly, that nothing changed but for that one substance of provision.
That's true.
It really just
would have made it easier for us.
Adds to these conversations.
I agree. That's not always the way it works, though. Any other questions of this witness? And this is our only witness. Okay. So, thank you, Heath.
Of course.
Is there anyone else who would like to testify on House Bill 3125A? Seeing none, we're going to close the public hearing on 3125A. We have all the paperwork, but do people want to look at this a little longer before we go to the work session, or are you okay?
I'm fine.
Whatever. Okay. So I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3125A. Senator Bearsher.
Yeah, Chair Roland, I move the A engrossed version of House Bill 3125 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Bearsugar moves that the A engrossed version of House Bill 3125 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none. Is there any opposition? Seeing none. It's been adopted. Anybody in particular would like to carry this bill? Okay. Senator Close will carry the bill. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2616. And we'll have a short explanation of the bill.
Chair Roebling, members of the committee, House Bill 2616 has an indeterminate revenue impact, and a statement has been issued. The bill also has a minimal fiscal impact. The bill makes the producer responsible for the payment of Oregon Wheat Commission assessments if the first purchaser of grain is outside of Oregon or is a governmental agency, or if the producer performs handling or processing functions for the first purchaser. It established as a civil penalty of 10% of the amount due plus interest for transmittal delay. It establishes a civil penalty for failure to relinquish assessment money equal to twice the amount unrelinquished. It authorizes the commission to take civil action or other available remedy to collect assessments, and specifies permissible types of accounts and investments for deposit of commission monies. It defines grain and producer for commission statutes and authorizes commission to levy assessments. And it also requires the commission to elect a secretary treasurer that will hold office no later than 30 days after the effective date of the bill. It requires that the chair, vice chair, and secretary treasurer be elected from the membership.
Okay. And we have Janet Jarvis here as our currently the only. So if there's anybody else out there that is dying to testify, you can let us know when we have a chance. But Janet, proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Janet Jarvis here today on behalf of the Oregon Wheat Commission. House Bill 2616 before you today is a result of some action we took a couple of years ago when we folded the Oregon Grains Commission into the Oregon Wheat Commission. And just as a point of reference, the Oregon Wheat Commission was the first commodity commission in the United States, established in 1947. And as such, it sits in its own section of statute. And so when we folded the Grains Commission in, there were some references that were left out a couple of years ago, and that's primarily the reason this bill is before you today. One of the most important pieces of that, of course, is the penalty provisions. The reference to the penalty provisions was left out. So while the Commission has the authority to assess growers, it doesn't have any penalty provisions to allow them to follow through if the assessment isn't paid. And so this corrects that. There's another section where if a producer, a grower, is dealing with an out-of-state grain elevator, it defines the responsibility for who is responsible to make sure that that assessment is paid. It also puts a definition of grains back in. That was left out when we folded the Grains Commission in. And the one new section in this bill is a section in Section 5 where it allows the Commission to handle their reserve funds a little differently. The Wheat Commission statutes require them to put these funds in FDIC-insured accounts. If you're trying to hold a year's worth of funds in reserve, that means that you have multiple accounts all over town. So this would allow them to aggregate those funds and put them in one account. And that's, in essence, the what is contained in House Bill 2616, and I'm happy to answer any questions if there are any.
Okay. Are there any questions? The only question I have is in the aggregate. So they will have a written statement from the bank that has it that requires that they will honor the full amount of the money that invested, like public schools and other people do?
Correct.
Okay.
Or they can put it in the state investment pool. That's
okay.
Another option
or
for
the state
them.
Investment
yes.
pool, which would also be one. So any other questions? Anybody else who would like to speak to House Bill 2616? Seeing no one, thank you. And we'll close our public hearing on 2616. And we'll open a work session on 2616. Senator Bear Sugar.
When he finds his glasses. Chair Roblin, I move House Bill 2616 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Barrett Sugar moves House Bill 2616 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, it is adopted. Anybody in particular want to carry this bill? If not, okay. We'll let Senator Przanski carry this one. Moving back and forth. And we'll close our work session on 2616. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2782A, and we'll have a short explanation.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, House Bill 2782A has no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact. It allows commodity commissions to amend rules relating to the number and geographic representation of commissioners. It declares any action taken by the commodity commissions having members not properly qualified as valid and lawful. It ratifies and declares valid any rule adopted by commodity commissions prior to the effective date of this act that created, amended, or abolished a rule or other requirement regulating the number or geographic representation of the members. It ratifies and validates the commission member appointments made prior to the effective date of this act. It declares an emergency and is effective upon passage.
So with that, we'll invite John McCulley, Roger Beyer, and Mike Dewey up. However you want to start.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Mike Dewey representing the Oregon Potato Commission. To get a little discussion about the Wheat Commission, the various commissions self-assess themselves, and that is how they pay for their marketing, their research, their promotion. And that's why Oregon potatoes are the best potatoes in the world, because of the research and marketing that we do. We support House Bill 2782. A few years back, these folks worked with us, and we rewrote the commission statute based upon a couple of court cases. And it dealt with the mandatory assessment. And the idea was to make sure that the speech of the commodity commissions was in some way, there was some oversight by the state, looking at their budgets, looking at their marketing programs, and the like. And so the State Department of Agriculture has oversight over the various commodity commissions, so we pay assessments to them. So it makes sense to have geographical membership for each commission. And in writing the statute, we felt as though, at least I did, that we probably had the protocol later on, if the planning patterns changed, to change the where the members came from. So in other words, if potatoes weren't grown in a certain district or area, we might have two come from another area. Well, the way it worked out is the Commodity Commission was initially formed by the state of Oregon. And as such, they set the boundaries, but there wasn't a provision in the statute for us later to change the geographical representation. We were surprised by that discussion from legislative counsel. But in reading the statute and how we did it, and that was our mistake, that was the conclusion that we reached. So this is a statute that allows us, or a bill that allows us, to change the representation. And we need to do that because we have one region of the state where, frankly, potatoes aren't being grown there for a variety of different reasons. So this is basically, if you will, in our minds, a housekeeping provision. Notwithstanding, some folks to my left and right have some ex facto issues here to deal with to make them clearly legal in what they've done previously. So I will stop there. Hopefully that was a cogent representation of what we're trying to do here.
Mr. Chair, I'm John McCulley. I'm here representing the tree fruit industry, which is the Oregon Sweet Cherry Commission primarily, but also I've served as administrator of the Oregon Processed Vegetable Commission, the Oregon Clover Commission in the past, and the Oregon Orchard Grass Seed Producers Commission. And Mr. Dewey, I think, correctly summarized what happened in 2003. This was a complete oversight on our part. The statute in 2003 created temporary commissions because we had to disband everything and start over again. But we neglected to provide the ability for the permanent commission to make these changes in geographic representation. And this was a complete oversight in the 2003 legislation, and this bill corrects that situation.
Kind of surprising. I don't know that we've ever made mistakes in legislation.
It's the first mistake I know we have ever made in lobbying on this bill. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Roger Beyer. I'm here representing the Oregon Grass Seed Commissions, and one of which is the Chewing Fescue and Creeping Red Fescue Commission.
My favorite commission, Mr. Chair.
And it is primarily because of that commission
that's
that
why
I am,
it's creepy.
I'm here to talk about what the version that, or the bill in front of you now under Section 1, Subsection 2. We had to add a section to this bill because this commission, if you recall, those of you who were here 2 years ago, we used to have a Highland Bentgrass Commission in the state, and 2 years ago we came in front of the legislature and abolished that commission and asked that the duties be transferred over to the Chewing Fescue and Creeping Red Fescue Commission. And in doing so, part of the agreement would be that this commission would add a new member in order to represent the Highland Bentgrass growers, which they did. And then they were notified by Attorney General that they might not have had the ability or the statutory authority to do so. So therefore, you see in this bill, we added a clause that would retroactively approve what they did and approve the what the commission has done since then, even though that one member being there would not constitute a quorum and they could still take action with the majority without them. This would just clear up any legal potential hurdles. So with that, we will give you the bill and ask you look favorably upon it and move it forward.
Happy any questions?
This is like deja vu. I just remember what the good Representative Beyer and Senator Beyer having these conversations from our side with people coming to fix something that, that needed to be redone. But we're here to serve. You got my vote.
Thank you.
And I want to do want to say that, you know, the commission system, the way we have done it in our state with ag having the authority to do the things, but the commission's working with ag, I think it's been a real boon to our deals. And whether it's the Seafood Commission or any of them that exist, they have, by self-assessment, they've been able to get out and get the market out there for the amazing number of producers we have in the state that produce a myriad of crops all around the state in an amazing way. I mean, they've done a really great job, and I think the commissions have helped them find their place and do the kinds of things. And I have been amazed over the last 8 years that I've been here how many times they come and say, well, you know, we can get along with this other group, so why don't you combine us to this one so that we have one? And I think those are good things to do when they can do that. If you can say that quickly, I'm really impressed with your commission.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I have a hard time reading it.
I had to practice for Senator Burbank.
So, I just want to commend anybody. Is there anyone else that would love to speak to House Bill 2782?
Thank you.
Thank you. Seeing no one rushing forward or raising their hand, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2782A, and we're going to open a work session on House Bill 2782A. Senator Bearsugar.
Chair Roblin, I move the A engrossed version of House Bill 2782 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Bearsugar moves that the A engrossed version of House Bill 2782 be moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? You know this is your favorite commission, so
it is she's my favorite. The bill.
Okay. So, is there any opposition to this bill? Seeing none, it is adopted, and Senator Jenny Burdick will carry this bill.
I'm honored, Mr. Chair.
Okay, very good.
I can't say enough about the Chewing Fescue and Creeping Red Fescue Commission.
Very good. Actually impressed. We're going to close the work session on Senate House Bill 2782A, and we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2441A. And with that, we'll have a short explanation, and it looks like we have a group of people, so you can start coming up. Gilbert Shibley, Gordon Gulbertson, and Jim James, as you go ahead and start your explanation.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, House Bill 2441A has no revenue impact and no fiscal impact. It authorizes the use of agricultural buildings customarily provided in conjunction with farm or forest use on land zoned for forest or mixed farm and forest use. It prohibits the conversion of such buildings to another use and modifies the definition of agricultural building to include structures located on forest operations, exempting such buildings from the state structural specialty code. It adds forestry uses to the definition of agricultural buildings, including storing or repairing forest machinery and equipment, and raising, harvesting, selling, preparing, storing, or disposing of forest products.
And with that, thank you all for being here, and whoever wants to start.
I'll start, Senator Roblin. Okay. And Senator Roblin and committee, it's a pleasure to be here today. My name is Jim James. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Small Woodlands Association, and OSWA is an organization that represents the interests of family forests in the state of Oregon. We believe that this bill gives equity to forest landowners the same advantage that agricultural landowners have. Today, if you wish to build a pole building on land zoned as ag land, there's nothing to restrict that from happening, and a lot of ag land owners do have pole buildings to store equipment and to help maintain their property as ag land. Forest landowners do not have that same ability, and what this bill would do would be provide that equity so that landowners who have logging equipment, who have equipment needed to manage their forests, could store it adequately. I've a couple of our members here are going to testify, and so I'll stop my testimony at that. But this is really an important bill to our members and all family forest landowners in Oregon.
Thank you.
Chair Roblin and members of the committee, I'm Gilbert Shibley at 24750 South Wallens Road, Estacada, at which address I live, and serve two different family property entities. Interestingly enough, one of those properties has such a building on it that I was able to put up because the land there is zoned EFU, even though it's one-fourth farm and three-fourths forest. And so I use the equipment that I have in that shop mostly on forest, but I was only able to use the simple pole building approach because it was on EFU land. Across the creek, another family ownership that I also am the family forester for doesn't need such a shop because it's close enough. But if it weren't located next to the one where I have the shop, the storage building, I would not have an ability to manage it well because I wouldn't be able to keep the tractor and the implements that I hook on and off of that tractor and the hand tools and the fire equipment that I have, an old four-wheel drive that I keep a tank on and a pump and so on. So anyway, I have lots of uses, and I manage the land better because I have such a building. But it's not really fair that one half of me didn't have the privilege and the other half did, but luckily we're good neighbors.
Senator Roblin and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. My name is Gordon Culbertson. I'm a resident of Lane County and a small woodland owner. Our family business, Whitewater Forests, owns and sustainably manages about 120 acres of forest land in Lane and Douglas counties. Our primary business is to grow and harvest commercial timber for sale to local log buyers. Both of our tree farms are certified under the American Tree Farm System. To perform our business activities, we own a small amount of equipment and vehicles, including a small crawler tractor, quad all-terrain vehicle, and a water tank and pump trailer for forest fire protection. We have a considerable investment in this machinery, and we try hard to maintain it in good working order. An important part of that care is protecting it from inclement weather. The machinery is used exclusively on our forest tracts. Our forest land is located a fairly long distance from our home place. So because of the logistics involved in moving the machinery, during the winter season, we prefer to leave it on the tree farms where we use it in course of our business. In an effort to protect our machinery, I recently investigated the purchase and construction of a simple pole building that would give us a dry and secure place to park our machinery. I decided that our tree farm located on Penn Road in West Lane County would be a great place for this small structure. I inquired with a local company who quoted me a price to produce and deliver a well-designed, prefabricated building kit that would meet our needs. The wood building would be 20 by 24 feet, supported with poles and protected with a metal roof. No electrical or plumbing, just a small covered garage with a gravel floor. They recommended a contractor available to help me put it up, and the price sounded like a reasonable investment. I was pretty excited to get going on this. I had known that there was an exemption to allow such buildings for agricultural purposes, not requiring a building permit, but I wasn't sure about forestry, so I inquired with Lane County. Quite soon, it became clear that my simple structure to protect my forestry machinery wasn't going to be so simple after all. For my building to be constructed, I discovered the following. Yes, we would need a building permit because it's not a farm building. The structure would be treated as if it were for human occupancy. An engineered building specification would be required. A pre-inspection, either by on-site visit or possibly a photo review, would be necessary. A site plan review and permit review with county officials would be needed. A fuel exclusion area for fire prevention, just like a home would require, effectively forcing me not to grow any young trees, maybe within hundreds of feet surrounding the building. Two copies of a site plan drawn to standard engineering requirements on 11 by 17 sheets had to be presented.
a building permit application form, site plan, two more sets of plans, including an engineering analysis, a foundation plan, a floor plan, cross-sections in detail, elevation view, floor and roof framing plan, wall bracing, engineering calculations, and truss specifications from the manufacturer would all be required. Also, my building kit is not likely suitable for forest land. It's for farm use, but forestry is another thing altogether, I was told. Payment of a $350 fee would be due at the meeting, in addition to the previous fee for hundreds of dollars for approval of a site plan. Lastly, county zoning restrictions may prohibit my pole building entirely, and if my building is rejected, none of these fees are refundable. After considering these requirements, it quickly became clear my simple pole building was not to be. It turned into a lose-lose situation for everyone. There would be no building to protect our machinery. Neither the local company that makes and sells the building kits nor the building contractor would have the business. Oregon lumber wouldn't be sold and used to construct a quality building. How ironic that it was virtually impossible for a structure made mostly of Oregon wood products to be built on a forest farm where trees are grown to make these wood products. As we speak, my water pumper trailer, specifically owned and maintained for the purpose of protecting forest resources from the summer's fire season, is rusting in the rain. Small woodland owners perform an important and crucial role in the management of Oregon forest lands. Many sawmills rely on timber produced from our woodlands. We enhance wildlife habitat, water quality, and recreational experiences. Farmers and foresters each share a common long-standing role, making a significant economic and environmental contribution to the state. Agriculture and forestry are very much the same process, with planting, growth, stewardship, and harvest. Each requires an investment in tools of the trade to be successful. A reasonable expectation is that similar business endeavors would be treated equally. House Bill 2441 offers an equitable solution to treat farmers and foresters on equal footing when it comes to practical and reasonable storage for our tools. I urge you to give it your support. Thank you very much for your consideration.
Thank you. Any questions for this group? Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. So we will next call up Representative Johnson, and we can have John Westall and Ian Tolleson as well. It's been our day to be in committees together.
Thank you. Is anybody else coming up now? Oh, there you are. Oh, I know you too. Man. Jeez, I have to share the dice with a new rising star. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. For the record, Mark Johnson, House District 52. And thank you for hearing this bill. It's a very practical bill. Living in my district in Hood River County, obviously we have a lot of farm acreage, exclusive farm land, and many times over the past years in my occupation as a builder, I've had the opportunity to put up accessory buildings for ag use on that land, and it's kind of a given. You know, you go down to the county building department, you tell the inspector there what you want to do, the plan reviewer, they say, okay, here's your permit fee, boom, go do it. As long as, you know, if you put in electrical, if you put in any other mechanical things, you have to have those permitted separately. That's really all we're asking for here in this bill, is that those folks who are owners of forest land, not farmland, who use their land for production, if you will. It's about raising trees. Yes, it's about harvesting timber and so forth. Have that same ability to just construct accessory buildings that can be helpful for them in their practice of forestry. So, again, they have to go through the same hoops. If, in fact, they're going to have electricity in there or any sort of other mechanical needs, they have to have separate inspections for that by the state to make sure that those things are installed successfully. But this is certainly not about creating condos in isolated forests. Settings. This is about simply a practical need that I think for whatever reason has been overlooked for too long. But I appreciate you all giving this bill a quick hearing, and I hope that we can move it through quickly. So we had no resistance in the House. Things are very successful there. I'm not aware of anyone who's testified in opposition to this. So appreciate your time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Do you have to go soon, or will
I'm overdue in a committee, okay. But that's okay.
Any questions
in the House? We're always kind of double booked.
I did have one question. It was my understanding that that these buildings would not have plumbing and electricity and so on, but and yet you said if they...
Well, I think electricity could be added if it's needful for lights and so forth, yeah. Typically plumbing, not, yeah.
A separate permit, but I could see a situation where you start out with one type of building, then end up with another use that is not contemplated. What protections are there in there to keep it from becoming a condo?
Well, again, those needs are not primary. They would be secondary. But if somebody had a need for a sink, let's say, to wash up or something, or water for one of their operations to wash off a piece of equipment or something, I could envision that perhaps being in there. But it certainly isn't in view by the vast majority of folks. Most of these are very rural locations where you don't have access to that sort of those utilities anyway. They just don't service that piece of acreage. So it's the intent is strictly to have it for that need that's specific to the practice. I'm just referring from farm buildings that I've worked on where, yes, there could be electricity in them. Some do have, you know, water because they're mixing spray and that kind of thing, so it fits in with farm practices and so forth. I can't speak to the exact specifics of how the forest practices would dovetail with that, but again, there's no habitation at all. It's not for occupation whatsoever. It has to be expressly targeted towards that forest use.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you. Could you tell us specifically, I know with our Oregon wood, because we have a lot of rain, we need to keep the product dry, like our pellets, and we do a lot of kiln drying. Would that be possible in that type of building, do you think?
As far as storage, is that
Yes, it would require heat.
Could be if they have a manufacturing facility on that location. That would be a different sort of a use, though, I think, for what's envisioned here. I think you're talking about, as we've heard, you know, cats, talking about saws. You're talking about things specific to forest practices, I think, rather than the actual commercial manufacture of pellets. That would be a different application. I think you'd have to have a different permit for that.
Storage of pellets, but they would have to be kept dry. That's always a problem, you know, because the humidity in the air. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Any other questions for our representative? Have a great time
Thank
in your
you.
Meeting.
You're on your own.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ian Tollison, Oregon Farm Bureau. I'll be brief. I think Representative Johnson and the other proponents did a well job of framing the issue and then our solution. I'm here to just let you know, as from the ag side of things, we're in full support of this bill. A lot of our own members have cross purposes that it would be helpful to use a building like this for storage. And I think that goes to really the heart of the bill. We certainly don't envision this to have any kind of habitation or any other use beyond that. The permitting process would definitely not allow that. And right now, as is, it's a good bill, and we urge your support. Thank you.
Any questions of Ian? If not, I'm going to have Mark come up. Mark, you want to come up? Building codes, because the Senator Burdick's question, I just like to make sure that if they actually wanted to put a person at, what would happen with respect to building codes and those kinds of things with regard to this kind of a building?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Mark Long, Administrator of Building Codes. I believe the question was, if the building goes in as an exempt structure, then what happens if they change the use to something else, condos, et cetera? They'd have to come to the building codes, local building codes department, or to the state, depending on where it's at, and get permits for that use, get land use planning and approval for that use, and go through the regular process. We would require the structure to meet full compliance, just like any other structure would if it was authorized in that area. I would imagine you'd have a land use problem, though, to begin with.
Yeah, I would say you have a big land use problem.
Another check and balance there.
Yeah. So I think we're okay that way. Yeah, but it's a good question, and I thank you for being here.
Oh, you bet.
And come on, Mr. Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Roger Beyer here, representing the Oregon Small Woodlands Association. Senator Burry's question, Senator, lines 9 and 10 of the printed bill, I think, answer that question. It's that we added this on the House side. A person may not convert an agricultural building authorized by this section to another use. So if a building is built, and my understanding of that means if a person wants to convert to another use, they can't. But they would, if they even want to apply, they would strictly have to go back through the land use process. But I think this is pretty clear that it wouldn't be allowed.
Thank Thank you. And I just wanted to get that on the record. That was certainly the tone of our conversation before, and I was just a little thrown off by
some
of the comments.
Yeah, I understand.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Happy to answer any other questions.
Thank you. Any other questions, sir, Mr. Byer? No. Is John Westall here? Did he want to speak? Did you want to? Okay. So we'll take that off. Just wanted to make sure. Is there anybody else that would like to speak to House Bill 2441? Okay. Seeing none, we're going to close our public hearing on House Bill 2441A, and we'll open a work session on 2441A. Senator Bearsugar.
Chair Roblin, I move the A engrossed version of House Bill 2441 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Bearsugar moves the A engrossed version of House Bill 2441 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? Seeing none, it is adopted. So it's down to Bearsugar or I on carrying this bill.
I'll take it.
Okay. That's really nice. Today. We have four bills. We got everybody around. Is there any, we're going to close the work session on House Bill 2441A. Any other stuff that needs to come? I think we have completed our work for the day, and I thank everybody for being here, and thank all of you who came today, and we are going to close our Committee on Rural Communities and Economic Development. Thank you. Have a great day.